The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for 2004's Dracula 3000. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch this movie before listening to the following podcast. Welcome back to the Redeeming Features cast in 2016, and we're starting off with a doozy. Is it good? Does it suck? We checked out Dracula 3000 from 2004 to see if we could find anything redeemable. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie do you think we should? It's got bad, I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time featuring the movie Dracula 3000 from 2004. I'm your host, Trevor Holland. I'm joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher. Thanks for having me back, Trevor.
Absolutely. And as a special treat to start off our new season of Redeeming Features, we have a special guest and the person who put us on to this movie here as well. David, how are you this evening?
I am very well, thank you very much.
Fantastic, thank you so much for exposing us to this movie. So some of the people out there, I suppose, know a bit about you. How about you just give us that quick little rundown on yourself and the sort of things you do.
All right, so my name's David, and I write at the moment. I'm a writer. I did a writing degree at university, and when I was doing that, I did a lot of film stuff as well. So that's the angle I'm coming from with this, is sort of a narrative and film structural kind of basic Bachelor of Arts thing. Yeah, and I have two podcasts of my own, and I also intern on a podcast called Priori.
No, that went well. Excellent.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you on board. So I'm glad we can come at it from a few different angles, because I'm sort of coming in from the angle of being a cult film buff, but it actually never heard. Well, she might have only heard loose mentions of this in the past, so I'm glad we had a recommendation for a film, because, yeah, Trevor and I are always looking for the the worst of the worst.
Is this your first encounter with this film?
It is, actually. So, and of course, going in, probably like a lot of people would have, going, oh, wow, it's a reimagining of Dracula from... I was going to say, it's a sequel to Dracula 2000, which I believe came out in 2000. So that was where I completely got locked and sort of...
That's what happened to me as well.
Now, it's interesting because I think in 1990, Francis Ford Coppola did a Dracula version, and then there must have been, the Dracula 2000, which, good or bad, must have been okay. I can't really remember. But, thinking it was linked to this.
Yeah, I watched a bit of Dracula 2000 in preparation for this as well, just to sort of jog my mind about it. Because how I got onto this film was, there was a Blockbuster near me when I first moved to Brisbane, and it was I used to go there, and they had this thing where $4 you could rent 7 DVDs for a week or something. And so I just rented every vampire film, every horror film I could find, every science fiction film I could find from them. And I just watch one every day almost. I try and watch them all in a week and then take them back. And so by doing that, I came across Dracula 2000 and Dracula 3000. They were right next to each other. And so they were presented very much as sequels to each other. And so I think I watched them basically straight after each other. So I had that kind of extra experience with it.
Oh gosh, it would have been a bit of a disappointment there, but it does make you one of the two if they were, but specifically actually trying to cash in on the title of Dracula 2000, because it kind of has that that thing in the back of people's minds. So I don't know, it might have been.
Yeah, it was 4 years later that they made this one, so I wouldn't be surprised if they were like, I don't know what they're originally trying to call it. It's got a subtitle of Infinite Darkness.
I thought it was quite strange. Like, obviously, it fits the theme of the film, but it kind of made it like they were wanting to establish a possible series, a possible direct-to-TV, direct-to-video series. So,
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Pardon,
some of it makes me think that they were really big fans of Alien, as well, and that they were trying to make a bit of an homage to Alien, and like the, you know, the, is it the tagline in Alien was, "In space, no one can hear you scream." And so wanted to do something. Someone must have been like, "Oh, well, like vampires would have it easy in space because the sun never sets or something." And that's the tagline of this one: "In space, the sun never sets, or the sun never rises.
In space, there is no daylight."
Yeah, something like that, which is complete, like depending on your vampire mythos, like how sun affects them. It's crazy because, like, if it's just UV light that kills them, like is most of our mythos that we know about, then that would be like, well, there's heaps of that bouncing around in space.
Oh, gosh. But probably the big thing that struck me, I think even before I started watching the movie, was the interesting lineup of cast in this. especially when you've, I don't know if he acts in many other things, but to see the name Coolio up quite strange.
And obviously, I remember. Hey, should I go through the cast really quickly? Because I made a bunch of notes about what I'd sort of seen them in before and whether or not it related to this. Shall I go through it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll start with we'll start with Abraham Van Helsing in this film, played by Casper Van Dien or whatever. He was I recognized him from Starship Troopers. So he's the main guy in Starship Troopers.
Yeah, that was his mate movie, and I think he's been milking his whole career off it ever since. trying to make one from it.
He's got the sort of appearance of that kind of sci-fi, gritty, unshaven kind of guy, ex-military kind of guy, and I think he does very well by doing that. But that's the main thing I remembered him from, and Sleepy Hollow. So I imagine the casting directors or whatever for this saw that he was in Starship Troopers, you know, as kind of sci-fi shooter thing, which is rather good, and he was in Sleepy Hollow, which is like a, you know, your supernatural thing, and they're like, that's going to be the perfect guy
for our combination of the two.
Yeah, our supernatural space movie. Erica was in this movie Bordello of Blood. I don't know whether you guys have seen that one, but if you like horrible vampire films, it's a horrible vampire film
that may now be on the list.
Bordello of Blood. It's presented by the Crypt Keeper, basically. What are your Tales from the Crypt? So it's framed like that. It's cheesy and gory and stuff like that. Just like, I think it's a 90s just cheesy vampire thing where nobody in it is taking it seriously. And actually, comparing it to this film, that is what actually redeems the Bordello of Blood, because they know that it's cheesy and horrible, and like they know exactly what they are. They're very self-aware about it, and they just try to make a really silly, fun kind of movie.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of films, you've got to understand your camp or your tongue-in-cheek if you're going to do a certain film. Something that I noticed this film sort of, it was taking itself a little bit towards, wasn't relinquishing that serious to have this go, let's just have fun and I come from the background of watching, you know, sort of the B-grade 50s and 60s sort of movies. And whilst it did feel that, that would have worked so much in a 50s and 60s film, the dialogue and a lot of what was happening, but it just didn't seem to sort of translate into, like, 2004, but you've also got, now, you probably correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got Udo Kier, who was in, was he in Flesh for Frankenstein, Andy Warhol, the Paul Morris film? I think he was in, he might have been in Blood and Dracula. So.
He's definitely in really Shadow of the Vampire, if you've seen that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I know that he's in one of those early Andy Warhol, I think Frankenstein, actually, or Dracula. Well, it makes more sense for him to have been in Dracula, so I'm thinking that might have been another reason why they've linked him with this film as well.
Yeah, I would not be surprised at all. I basically was, when I was looking at IMDb of these guys, I was just looking at ones that I'd seen, and I haven't seen those, unfortunately.
In terms of, and I think this would have been Coolio's only movie, I'm not sure.
I swore that he was in Leprechaun Back to the Hood, you know, the Leprechaun films. But I looked it up on IMDb, I was wrong. Yeah, but he's been in TV shows. He played Quanzabot in Futurama before this film came out, and he played a demon in Charmed. So I was like, well, maybe that's where they were coming from when they got him on board. But he's just playing such a stereotype, and it's really sad. I mean,
yeah, but that said too, like, you know, not, of course I don't want to jump too far ahead of myself, but yeah, that was one thing. Like, he was someone who sort of was aware of its sort of tongue-in-cheekness of the film,
yeah.
You know, if everyone else really had as much fun as, you know, Killio's terrible in it, but if everyone else had as much fun as he has in it,
yeah,
I think the film would be a total killer fish, like.
Yeah.
But I'm jumping ahead of myself, so.
Grant was in Blood Diamond and The Fall, but those were both after this film. So I was just thinking those are the only things I knew him from. I believe he was the guy who played the doctor, the professor, the guy in the wheelchair. And Tiny Lister was in Fifth Element before this, playing the president.
For some reason, I thought that was like a porn name or something like that. There's something about that name.
That name. No, anyway. I laugh every time I hear it. He's probably my favorite actor in this film. I really like him, and I know he kind of gets typecast a lot, but and maybe he's not a great actor, but he is enjoyable. He has a good screen presence. But his name, Tiny Lister, you guys know Red Dwarf, right?
I don't. Yeah,
yep, I do.
Oh, okay. I'm going to talk about Red Dwarf a bit more when we're talking about this film, but there's an episode of Red Dwarf called DNA, where the character of Lister gets made really tiny. And so I was reminded of that.
Oh, okay. It could have been his stage name based on that. You never know.
I imagine they call him, his name's Tommy Lister, and they just call him Tiny because he's a massive dude. But,
makes sense.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm dropping ahead. I was just going to say the big thing when I was sort of going into it, I thought I did a little bit of background research, and yeah, the big thing that was coming out to me was everyone was saying this was quite a boring film, so I'm like, I'm going to give this a go, but I always get excited when a film comes in under 90 minutes. That's the perfect length for a film, and I still felt even for an hour or 20, I was still going, oh gosh.
Yeah.
This felt like Gone with the Wind, even though I love Gone with the Wind, but you know, it felt like 3.5 hours.
trying to get into it. Yeah, the opening credits alone apparently clock in at like 3 minutes or something.
They do keep going.
But there's something about the opening. Actually, I've got in my notes here, the opening theme and the credits seemed kind of cool, and then I see Coolio's name and it all went downhill from there.
Yeah, excellent. Before we go too much further, better rein this in, as fascinating as it is, but we need to just tick off a few boxes first. What we like to do, if you haven't heard the podcast before, is we have a little section we just call Turkey Trivia. So we talk about the actual facts about the movie before, and a bit of trivia as well, before we dive into the full-on discussion. And Christian always jumps ahead, but that's okay.
I know, I'm excited.
So this has got a grand total of rating, grand rating of 2 out of 10 on IMDb. I couldn't find any budget information, but it's obviously a straight-to-video movie, so that's not that unusual. And the synopsis, when you go looking it up, is a salvage ship on a routine mission discovers a transporter vessel that has been reported missing 100 years earlier. When the salvage crew boards the vessel, they discover 50 long black coffins. Ooh, spooky. And this trivia-wise, I know I mentioned it before, but despite its name, it's not actually a direct sequel to Dracula 2000. In fact, there's some speculation that they may have chosen the name Dracula 3000 to cash on some of the latent fame from the Dracula 2000 movie.
Yeah. If anyone's interested, Dracula 2000 does have two sequels, though, which I haven't seen, but one of my housemates has.
God, I hope they're better than this film. But anyway.
despite being called Dracula 3000, there's no actual Dracula character in it, which we'll touch on later, but as part of the trivia, the vampire's name is Orlok, which was the name of the vampire in Nosferatu.
Ah, so again, another homage or another link.
Yeah, it's also the name of the vampire in Shadow of the Vampire, which is the one that Udo Kier is definitely in.
Right.
Played by Willem Dafoe. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. And then the flashbacks to the captain of the derelict ship. That's actually meant to mirror Dracula's sea voyage to England in the novel.
Yeah. Have you guys read the novel of of Dracula?
No, I haven't, to be honest. I should have, actually.
It is really good.
Long time ago.
Yeah. If you're going from, like, watching all the old, like, Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee kind of Dracula films, you're going to get a few shocks, but it is an excellent piece of literature. Yeah.
So I think I was coming into this quite blind, actually, I suppose, and, you know, pretty much basing it all off sort of, past films I'd seen, I suppose. So, I felt a lot when I was watching it that I wish I knew more of the story. I was finding myself kind of Googling different names and things, so...
Yeah, especially The Voyage of the Demeter is like, it's a big not a big section, I suppose, of the book, but it's a part of the book that they don't really do in the movies at all. The ship sort of just arrives and the wolf jumps off or whatever, and so you don't really get that. But there's a lot of things that will only focus on The Voyage of the Demeter. Like, that will be the entire narrative of the stuff. Like, there's a bunch of comics and films that is kind of just... writing about that. And this, this falls under that. Yeah, it's worth reading and it's not very long.
Cool. Well, before we get back into the movie proper, we do like to set a baseline from which to build from. So we actually kind of start at the bottom and then try to work our way up, see if we can actually raise the bar. But we do like to start with a 1-star review sourced from Amazon. And I found, I think, quite a succinct one. The title of the review is Burn This Movie for the Sake of All Mankind. This movie
I wrote that.
That's all right. This movie is the worst thing ever to be put on film. For the love of God, do not see this movie. I know that when there are so many bad reviews that one person out there is going to say, gee, maybe I should see what they're all talking about. Really? Don't. When I am 75 years old, I will still remember the flashbacks of how I wasted 2 hours of my life seeing this movie. It will forever scar me how insulting this movie is to the general public. My IQ dropped 10 points because of this movie. My wife divorced me because I could not stop talking about how bad this movie is. I acquired a drug problem trying to stop the images in my head. So bland, so moronic. I remember the day when we saw this movie and both me and my friend simply sat there with our mouths wide open, stared at how completely stupid this movie is. This movie and all copies of it must be banned and burned for the sake of all mankind. 1 star.
That is an awesome review.
Yeah. I think he's being a little dramatic. Shall I just say, though, another interesting parallel to the original Nosferatu film. Where it was banned and all copies were burned.
Mm.
Oh, there you go. So maybe...
the Catholic Church ordered every copy to be burned and destroyed for the sake of mankind.
There you go.
I don't think it bans on this, but anyway, I don't want to jump too far ahead. But interesting review there. So we can only go up from here, hopefully.
Yep, that's what we've got to build on. So
I'm interested to see if you found a 5-star review for this. That's going to be...
Well, we shall wait and see, shan't we?
David, you're getting too far ahead of yourself. I've got to bring you in.
Absolutely. You actually already mentioned it, Christian, and I think it too. When I saw this was 83 minutes, first thing I thought was, good. There's way too many movies out there that just far outstay their welcome. So when I see a nice, succinct one in front of me, I immediately get a good feeling. Whether that feeling stays good kind of depends on what happens afterwards. But I must admit, I did like the tagline in the opening credits of "In space, there is no daylight." That was just a bit badass.
Yeah.
Such a B-grade tagline, isn't it? Or a B-movie tagline. So very good.
And actually, the other thing from the opening titles I was quite focused on is the producer slash director slash writer, and apparently someone who has handed nearly every single aspect of this movie by the amount of times his name came up was Daryl James Root, R-O-O-D-T. So he seems to be quite keen to let everyone know that he was a big name in the making of this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a good career move, but hey, at least he's enthusiastic about it.
I was going to say, he could get his name removed from the credits, but they'd just have to remove the credits entirely.
it kind of seems like his little pet project or something
that wouldn't have gone too well. Because as Trevor said, you know, you can't find any budget details, and I suppose they don't really have too much info on sort of rentals or sort of how much the movie made. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to know how much this guy lost from this, but interesting gamble.
Yeah. I know it's gone. It went out of print in 2007.
I'm surprised it wasn't earlier. But anyway, I'm jumping ahead of myself.
I just looked up his filmography, and there's nothing I recognize. But he is a South African filmmaker primarily, so it's a lot of stuff that I guess people would know if they're from South Africa. I don't know.
He might have a big following there. Hey, this might have been the only country where Dracula 3000 went well.
Must have gone all right in Spain that I can find a. It's super easy to find a Spanish version and not any other language.
Yeah, you can. There are copies out there, and you can still purchase copies if you look around.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
You know whether or not you want to go to that effort. Well, I guess.
I think I will.
I'm getting ahead of myself again.
I think I will buy a copy because I'm annoyed that I don't own it now.
Fantastic. So, let's see. I mean, the opening credits, though, I mean, we do know that person's name very, very well because, as Christian mentioned earlier, those credits do keep on going for quite some time.
Yeah. He wasn't alone, though. He had a bunch of co-producers, producers, extra producers, and extra writers working with him by the sounds of it as well, that are all listed in the opening and then the closing credits.
Okay, well, I guess that's where most of the budget went then, and not was left for the actual movie.
But do you remember the closing credits? It was just a still photo of an explosion with it. It just looks like something from a TV movie. And even though Trevor mentioned it being 83 minutes, I'm thinking myself, God, when you only have to do the math when opening credits and closing credits go for almost 10 minutes. Are you going to have much of a movie there?
Yeah.
I even found in that time it was quite, I even found that I was still even looking at the watch or seeing how long I had to go. So when that happens with a short film, you know you're in trouble. But
yeah.
Excellent. One thing I noticed quite a bit throughout the movie, though, before we get into, I suppose, specific scenes, was they really liked a good close-up.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
It was just so many just right in the actors' faces. May have been an attempt so that they didn't have to show as much, any more of the set than they absolutely had to, potentially.
Yeah.
They may have been filming some of it in someone's living room for all we know. You can't tell because everything with the actors is largely in this extreme close-up.
Yeah.
And I think too, but then not to think too deep about it, but the fact too, I think that's also too maybe their way of sort of enhancing the claustrophobia of where they were sort of at. I don't know if that's looking a bit too much into it, but also too, when you think it being, I don't know if it's a technique with television movies, but this isn't been made to be on a huge screen where, because you imagine those close-ups on a big screen, it'd be scary, you know. But I think that they can sort of get away with a lot more sort of tight shots like that on a small screen for the film. But I think, Trevor, I wouldn't be surprised if it's what you said. A lot of them probably would have been filming in front of like a cardboard box at home somewhere with this really tight shot. So I think it was probably a budget restraint. But you know, I do like to think of it as being sort of from a creative angle, but they were trying to get that claustrophobia, which was quite obviously prevalent through the whole thing. But, you know, I know you mentioned earlier about it being similar to Alien, and God, that's where I sort of see the similarities, especially with that sort of style. But hey, I suppose they are in a spaceship. It's not exactly going to be this most vast thing, but yeah, no, I think that might have been a lot to do with the close-ups. But yeah, I did notice that too, Trevor.
It really does go for a lot of those tropes, though, when you think about the Alien movies and the horror movies, running down corridors, shaky camera work, which is just used at random times.
Yeah,
even sometimes for no apparent reason. There's just suddenly a shot of a wobbly camera going down a corridor.
Maybe they're going to wake the audience up. They've probably been dozing for the last 10 minutes. So I don't know. But I think, like I mentioned earlier about it being very, you know, like a lot sort of like B-grade sort of films, and I felt that the dialogue and a lot of the, you know, as you said, a lot of the tropes and things like that were very much, you know, so like cliches from Hollywood. But I think the tone of it was completely off, that it didn't really sort of embrace these tropes. It sort of more just threw everything in and just hoped a movie would come out the other end. So I don't know. And I think, like I mentioned earlier with Coolio, like even though he was terrible, you know, once he was bitten and he started doing his, you know, crazy man thing.
Once he stopped playing Coolio the stoner and started playing Coolio the creepy dancing elf.
Like he was having fun with it. It was like he was in on the joke and the rest of the cast weren't. I think if they'd all played that sort of feel, it would have been a totally different movie and it would have fitted a lot of the dialogue because, I can't write dialogue very well, but I find that when I listen to movies and some of this dialogue is absolutely terrible, especially when you sort of, and then trying to say it with a straight face.
Yeah. Coolio, he really went for it. I mean, you've got to admire the fact that he was during like some of the chase scenes where he was, once he was turned into a vampire, he was like jumping on the walls, leaping over railings. And then when he does his bit being the thrall of the vampire Orlok, more on him later, just crawling around on all fours and jumping across tops of coffins in this cargo hold that suddenly has mist for no apparent reason. I mean, it was just...
And just mugging for the camera too, like licking his teeth and bugging his eyes out and, you know, turning his head around and stuff, just,
Considering how very low-key, I'll be generous, the other performances are, it really does stand out.
but I also think it was probably him going, oh my God, I've got to give this movie some kind of life, you know. Yeah. So I think it was bad, but it was still entertaining at the same time. It kind of was something you kind of welcomed. But yeah, you were sitting back going, oh my God, this is so B-grade. But yeah, so maybe it's an actor going, shit, this is my one chance of being in a movie. I'm gonna ham it up as much as possible. So
well, yeah. The I suppose we'll be talking about this a bit later, but you could argue that the vampire virus or whatever it is that is happening to them when they get changes you from being a lifeless actor into a ham, because everybody who kind of gets turned suddenly starts being kind of like they just stop taking things seriously. Not everyone, I suppose, there's a few exceptions, but like and Orlok himself is just nuts, but we'll talk about him later.
Let's just say his appearance just sort of took it to a whole new depth.
Yeah.
I mean lower rungs when I say depth. but then you've got like I mentioned the sort of the bit the B grade style dialogue, and you know when they stumble on Udo Kier's skeleton at the start and they you know I've got the line here, I know to Aurora, I know how much you like it stiff, you know, and as soon as I heard that line I'm like, oh, are they going to just keep doing lines like this, and yep, it continued.
Oh, absolutely.
I think
trying to do that with a real straight face was just quite strange. Sorry, Trevor.
No, I was thinking like when it first started, when they first discovered the ship, and they sent the character Mina over by herself to explore it. She steps in, and the first thing she says is, "Hello, anyone home?" And then when things start getting spooky, which is signified by a shape running past the camera suddenly, and she starts panicking. They go back to the ship where the captain, Van Helsing, and the professor are talking to her, and she's panicking and going crazy, and the professor just goes, this is disconcerting. That's a great reaction. Good on you.
Yeah.
But he did redeem himself in the scene where Mina gets crash tackled by Coolio, which was an amazing bit of sudden action in the middle of this, and he just goes absolutely nuts, just pulling himself on this giant wheel that's on this bulkhead door, just going, don't bring her back! And I'm thinking, wow, that is scenery chewing. That's such a strong attempt at it. It's not quite getting there, but hey, B... Yeah, C plus for effort.
Yeah, don't be too generous.
Yeah, gumming the scenery.
Gumming the scenery, perfect.
Oh, but then, you know, I've mentioned got here too, like when later on in the movie when they've got the crucifix and the guy's like, oh, what the plus sign? And you're like going, oh gosh, you know, it's I don't know, they were really trying to show the whole boneheadedness of some of these characters. But
well, I remember the crucifix had been banned 50 years earlier.
Yeah, there's this, should we talk about the world building where religion seems to have been outlawed and the Soviet Union has reformed?
But like it's only introduced when it's required to explain why they don't know what a crucifix is, like everyone's also forgotten all the mythology ever about vampires over the past few centuries because they actually go look it up on their equivalent of Wikipedia.
But I thought that even going in not really knowing the Dracula story that well, I think even using the name Van Helsing kind of set it up, like, for Casper Van Dien's character was kind of a bit strange, because then, yeah, you've got to try and... Yeah, are they remembering sort of everything that's happened in the past for these characters? Is it supposed to be the same character? It was just, I think it was a really weird decision. Like, I would have probably preferred more people terrorized by Dracula in space being the plot, rather than sort of going the angle of Orlok or whatever, you know, sorry, rather than, using the whole Van Helsing thing, because it made me sort of go, okay, cool, we assume this is that same, I suppose, pop culture, no, that's probably the bad word, but this literature.
Naming him Van Helsing sets him up as the hero of the movie, but it doesn't really end up that way.
No, exactly. I suppose they thought they were being clever doing that, but all it does is create more confusion than anything.
It just adds even more at being further away from the Dracula story, and that was... And it almost felt like it sort of came in kind of late into the movie at the last minute, sort of, oh, we better kind of explain it. Oh, we better tie it in somehow. And it was sort of a little too late, I think. Too little too late.
Yeah, they do kind of try to tease him as being their hero, because when they're looking it up, they actually find the name Van Helsing. Looking up, and he has already stabbed Coolio through the heart with a pool cue.
Yeah, because
apparently pool cues are like the only thing in the universe still made of natural wood, which is another thing that they managed to explain and force into the plot.
Because, you know, pool cues have to be made of wood. No other thing.
Can't use that artificial wood for a pool cue. No way.
Can't even make the pool table out of wood anymore. It's just pool cues.
It's just weird that it was even there. In space, no one can hear you play pool. I don't know, it's just a bizarre thing.
the different sets are, there's the rec room, there's, like, the bridge, I guess. There's
the same all the corridor stuff that, used half a dozen times.
Yeah, there's all those corridors and stuff. I imagine they took a day trip to some sort of a submarine or big ship or something or factory, and just had all those walkways and just shot all those scenes of them running around and being crazy, and then they shot the rest in like sets, I guess. But everything's color coded. I noticed that, which I can't decide whether I like it or I don't like it. I suppose it. Yeah, so there's the rec room is color coded as blue. When she first arrives on Demeter, I suppose because everything's dark, it's blue. But then the corridors are kind of yellow. Julio's room is red. I think the bridge is purple. Stuff like that. It's a really interesting thing where they must have been like, maybe they were using the same set and just painting it a different color each different day or something to make it look different.
That sounds like a low budget technique, so I wouldn't be surprised if they tried it with this. And it sort of goes in with the whole, as we said, the close ups as well too. So I think they were being very clever. Hey, maybe it was filmed in someone's backyard or garage.
Yeah, exactly.
Put up a few plywood walls, you set.
But it was really the one thing that sort of struck me the whole time while I was watching it is I was unsure sort of who the target audience is, because you kind of got these people that would have been going in like thinking possibly it was a Dracula, you know, like a sequel to Dracula 2000 or an official Dracula film. So I was, but then it kind of came across, remember Trevor, we did that film last year, I think it was DOA, I think it was, kind of felt very much in the spirit of that kind of film as well. And I was thinking, the whole time, who was this really sort of going for? But I think it was really just obviously not people that were after good dialogue and good performances. But I'm just sort of like, I think they just threw everything to a wall and saw what would stick.
It's a common technique, I think, in some of these movies, just, okay, we'll just try this and see what works, and if it works good enough, we'll edit it into something which follows a plot.
I was going to say, in a lot of ways, it feels like they were basically trying to go with pastiche being the main thing, like just being like, hey, remember this other film that was kind of good / cheesy / you liked? This film has that thing. So I feel like they were like, hey, if you're a Dracula fan, we have bits of that. If you like action, okay, we have that. You know, if you like stoner comedies, we have a bit of that, but none of it is done with any knowledge of the actual content. So it all just comes together as some sort of glued together mass of just random kind of assortment. It's not completely random. It's like, yeah.
And something that I don't think that imagine three people would be discussing 12 years later, I suppose. I don't think necessarily time has made it better or worse. I think it would have been exactly the same feeling when it came out. So, I think it was a very much a, let's try and use some, I don't know, cult actors, even though there are very few other people in it. You know, let's try and, do whatever you can to try and get bums on the seats or bums in front of the TV in this case. So, so I really, it would have been interesting to see if it was a, it would have, I suppose, been directed DVD or was it, did it play on TV first? I think it was directed DVD or.
It was directed video.
I wouldn't put this on TV. But yeah. But anyway, we digress.
Obviously, they were trying lots of ideas. There's one thing that I think really stood out to me, again, when they were researching about what vampires were and what was going on. And they find the name Van Helsing. And they work out that this derelict ship, that this other ship, captained by Van Helsing, happens to come across and get involved with. From the fact that Van Helsing fought vampires centuries ago, it might be some sort of revenge plot. And but that just never gets mentioned again, not even by Count Orlok himself.
It's such a dumb moment. If I was making this film, I would have just gotten rid of all of the Van Helsing kind of references. It just made it a film about vampires in space.
Exactly. That's one thing that, like, I'm a big fan of the Friday the 13th series, and even though Jason X, the one when Jason goes to space, pretty much is a bad film, at least that sort of was just like taking something and, you know, doing putting what we said should have been the story like this in space rather than bringing in these sort of Van Helsing. But I think they're trying to think that they're being pretty clever. Oh, we'll link it in by using the same name, but I think it would have just thrown even more confusion into the mix.
Yeah.
We've mentioned him a few times. We probably should talk about the big bad, Count Orlok. I couldn't take him seriously. I found him about as menacing as a sea sponge.
Yes. All right. He's not even like menacing in the fight scenes or anything. Like, he only comes across as, like, vaguely sexually menacing when he's kind of inappropriately touching Aurora. I think if we're talking about... Are we ready to talk about the worst parts of this film? Because I feel like the worst part of this film, the silliest, most horrible part, is him running in the corridors by himself. It looks fake, it looks silly, it looks hammy, it doesn't have any effect on the plot, and nobody cares about that bit. It is just the worst.
Yeah. You mean you think that's worse than when his most menacing bit where he's trying to push through the door to get to them, and they close the door and chop his hand off? Worst vampire ever!
it's a magic hand because it changes from right to left, I think, or left to right after it gets chopped off.
He seems like a reject from a pantomime or some musical or some high school musical or something like that. And it just seems to wander onto set and say a couple of lines and then leave again. It just seems so out of place. I can't think of the title offhand, but there's a couple of sort of 70s blaxploitation sort of Dracula films of the late 70s. And it reminded me a lot of something out of that.
Just completely just stitched into the thing without... like any attachment to anything. He's still the count from like the 1800s.
I noticed that too. In the year 3000, the vampires still wear capes, and the vampire women, because there's a vampire woman that just kind of turns up briefly out of nowhere and gets killed just about as quickly. She's in full Victorian garb. They all dress like that on the planet of Transylvania?
Is she not Mina?
That's probably a point.
Makeup and her hair done?
Yeah, I think potentially.
Well, actually.
I'm pretty sure it is.
But they didn't, it's bad filmmaking because they didn't actually show her getting captured or anything. Everyone stops referring to her after a while. Oh no, she gets crash tackled.
She gets crash tackled by Coolio.
Everyone's like, oh well, Coolio will take care of her or whatever. And then next time you see her is when they open up the coffin and she's there. And she looks totally different because up until that, like before, she never wore makeup. Now she's wearing red lipstick and eyeshadow and eyeliner and stuff. And instead of having her hair in pigtails, it's all like I don't know, done nice, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's out. And and I think she might be dressed differently.
Yeah, and she's dressed completely differently. She's in a full Victorian dress.
Yeah, and it's like, what the hell?
Coolio didn't get that treatment when he got turned into a vampire. What's going on?
Yeah, he was too busy jumping around the ship to get changed.
Yeah, he wouldn't hold still.
Dracula's like, I'm trying to do your lipstick. Hold still.
I'm fine. Just go. Be a mess.
Yeah, go crash tackle someone.
You guys are much more entertaining watching the movie, trust me. Oh, gosh.
I think the worst moment for me in a lot of series of worst moments was probably right towards the end where the character Aurora, who... doesn't get bitten by Count Orlok because it turns out she's a robot who's been spying on them all.
Yeah, just a robot. She used to be a sex bot, is that
exactly
right?
Exactly right. At the end, because she's this investigation bot, but at the end she admits to being a sex bot to our good friend Tiny Lister, or Humvee, as he's known in the movie. And he breaks down saying, I've heard about sex bots, but I've never had the credits. And then he's just like, well, let's do it then.
Yeah.
What?
And he throws her over his shoulder.
Yep. And then there's a little after credits scene where he just smacks her on the bum.
He says, that's what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Let's completely undermine the actual female lead of this movie.
Yeah.
By turning into a sex toy at the end of the movie.
Exactly. It's basically just saying, yeah, this is what women are or whatever. Like, it could have been something redeemable about this film could have been that there was a strong, powerful female who, like, she doesn't get any good lines, but if they'd given her good lines as well. But, like, if they'd made her out to be independent and stuff, but right at the end, they didn't need to do it. They just decided to sexualize her and make her an object.
Very much. And just before the move finishes, literally, with a bang.
Yeah, and that also feels like they just ran out of time and ran out of cares, and they were just like, let's just do
this. Let's crash them into a star and let everybody die.
That's probably why they call the Dracula 3000 Infant Darkness. I think if we add a little thing at the end, we can call the next one, I don't know, Dracula 3000, the Sexbot Years or something. I don't know.
The Adventures of Aurora Sexbot and Tiny Lister.
Hey, I'd watch that.
they'd have to really do some explaining because, like I just said, they all crash into a star.
Yeah.
I just popped into my head now, there's a surfboard in Coolio's room, and when I first saw that, I was like, how do you surf in space? But there is a movie called Dark Star. Have you guys seen this movie?
No.
That's John Carpenter, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it's like his first film that he made. It's kind of a student film that he added bits to, and it went on to basically become Alien. When he started working with other people and stuff like that. So it's almost set in the same universe as Alien. It's a very, very interesting film. So if you haven't seen it, go and watch it. I've watched it a whole heap of times already. It is really low budget, but the kind of stuff that it deals with is really interesting, I feel, and enjoyable enough to watch.
Are you saying it's got space surfing?
It has space surfing. Spoiler alert for anybody who was going to watch Dark Star, but it does have, like, at the end, just watch it to hold out for the scene, even. There's a guy who surfs in space, and it's amazing.
I'm holding out for the space pool movie, where they play pool.
that's probably the other thing I wanted to touch on with this movie as well. I mean, it's the year 3000. But my goodness, everything is still so low tech. I mean, you wouldn't envision that they would still have manual wheelchairs.
Yeah.
You thought that there'd be some sort of system in there to let him drive that thing, the professor drive it around rather than having to push
himself. The thing is, Trevor, they would have higher tech unless something horrific's happened in the universe, like, say, the Soviet Union has reformed, and something like that. Something's clearly happened in this world, and so technology, maybe it's in a bit of a dark ages or something at the moment.
Wow, yeah. My eyes are open. This movie is completely great now.
I imagine they were just like, well, first of all, why did they want to cripple in the film? I suppose they wanted to toy with the idea of vampirism would heal him of his little problems and stuff. Or
they did touch on that. Not that they did anything with it.
No, like, it feels like they were just like, oh, I think one of the Aliens films, but I think it came out after this one. Maybe it's Alien 4 Resurrection, the one that everyone kind of hated before Prometheus came out. But I think it had a guy in a wheelchair in it. And it was very reminiscent of that. And he had to be carried and stuff because they don't make spaceships wheelchair accessible or something like that.
Especially in the year 3000.
Yeah.
I did find out, though, when he was turned into a vampire, he was killed by just having Aurora stab him in the back with a metal crucifix. I didn't think that was meant to work.
Yeah, he might not have died. I don't know.
Yeah, he didn't do anything, that's for sure. He just sat there and took it.
I believe the line there is, how do you know he was a vampire? And she says, I didn't. Is that right?
Pretty much. That's pretty close. He just assumed.
I was just stabbing him in the back with a crucifix. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that dialogue.
Oh, it's so cheesy. I do remember lots of it. Was just terrible.
but then had a bit more fun with it all across the board. I think it would have been totally different movie because that dialogue was just screaming out for it, and especially all that. Situations and those references to other films. Yeah, I thought that was quite it was a wasted opportunity. And as a result, the film feels kind of like hollow, quite meh. I don't know, it almost felt sort of I don't know, but anyway, I'm kind of irredeeming it at the moment, so sorry. What were we gonna
say? On that note though, I feel like this film is very reminiscent of an American version of Red Dwarf. Not the American version of Red Dwarf, but Red Dwarf was a very low budget thing, and the sets were rather similar. And they dealt with a lot of pop culture stuff and references to things like this does. And they deliberately put in cheesy jokes and dialogue and stuff. But because they were doing it as a comedy, because Red Dwarf is primarily a comedy, it works amazingly well and has huge fans and a cult following and stuff like that. But the trouble with a film when it takes itself too seriously and thinks it's making a badass film or whatever is that it doesn't. People just go, no, this is way too cheesy, and they're laughing at it and not finding it engaging or interesting at all.
And so it's like Coolio was in on the joke but no one else was. And that would have meant, and I think, they took it to themselves way too seriously, which is interesting considering the subject matter that you think they'd be looking at this going, we can have a lot of fun with this and really sort of camp it up or sort of make it this really action-packed, adventure film. But, unfortunately, it just becomes quite empty and meh.
I get the feeling that maybe Coolio wasn't following directions because, like, when he gets vamped up, it's so different to the feel of the rest of the movie. Yeah. But they probably just didn't have the money or the budget or the time in which to do extra takes. So it's just like, well, we're going to have to put that in the movie.
That'll do. I'm surprised they didn't even try to link him in and get him to do some songs on the soundtrack or something like that. There wasn't even
anything
in that respect.
It would be amazing to be able to put like a Coolio song from Dracula 3000 at the end of the podcast, but alas, not happening.
He is listening to rap music when he is smoking his hookah at the start, but I don't know what the song is or anything. I am not hip to the scene.
Yeah. Never know, it could have been one of his, but maybe not. They probably wouldn't be able to afford it. They're probably lucky to afford him, even though I don't think he would. Actually, by 2004, I don't think Coolio was exactly hot property, so...
No.
Was there anything else from the viewing that anyone particularly wanted to discuss in a bit more detail? Oh, there's a lot of very crazy, odd, and just
I have something.
What the scenes? Yep.
The crowbar just sort of appears out of nowhere. Like Coolio reaches, he knows exactly where it is under the pipe or whatever. He just finds it, and because they needed something to open the coffins with. And more importantly, he needed to cut his hand to get blood on the sand or whatever.
Well, yeah.
But he, he finds it, and then he goes to give it to Tiny, but Tiny doesn't take it because Tiny can open coffins with his feet, apparently. But and then later on, Abraham Van Helsing just sort of picks it up, just sort of finds it as well. It's this one little tiny crowbar, not even like an impressive crowbar or a half-life crowbar. It's just this small little crowbar, this Jimmy bar that I found so amusing because it would just sort of show up when it was needed.
Alien crowbar. Actually, yeah. Now that you mention the coffins, because they do bust open quite a number of those things, but towards the end they go back there, and I swear. All the coffins are intact.
Yeah, yeah. Dracula's been like, oh, I've got to clean this mess up.
Gets his hammer out and fixes them back up again.
He's been spending 100 years repairing the coffins and then people come and break them again.
God.
Oh, gosh. So, yes, a few interesting things about this film.
Awesome. Well, we might move on to see if we do have any redeeming features and if this movie can be considered redeemable overall, and I think it's only fitting that we let our guest David go first. So David, okay. What would you consider would be you can talk redeeming or irredeemable, both work, and what's your overall verdict as to whether or not this movie is redeemable?
All right, so the main thing that I want to talk about is the set design, mostly the choice of. So the hallway scenes, I thought that they were really good. Not that the scenes were good, but the sets for those scenes were good. And you get to see a lot of them. They were really proud of them. They film a lot of like running around in hallways. But yeah, I feel like the major redeeming thing is, especially talking about physical stuff, not talking about life lessons that we've learned from it or whatever, is that someone scene scout was like, oh, there's this like old battleship or whatever we can film in, and they went and did it. And so yeah, I think that was good. And the color coding, I still don't know whether I love it or whether I hate it, but yeah, I thought that was nice. I think I hate it. I think they didn't do enough with the colors to make it good. So that the hallways. I really like the sets. Is the main thing, and I was gonna say all of the sets, but they just, especially towards the end, the sets were getting worse and worse. They were just, it was clearly plywood and stuff. But some of the terminals were good and things like that. So as far as the science fiction set, considering there was little else that was actually science fiction about it, like you talk about, they've got bullet shooting guns. They're using a freaking scuba gear. Like when they first get on the Demeter, they're not using spacesuits. Like they have just goggles on with tubes going to some sort of container on their back, which they don't even need apparently. I didn't even get that. But yeah, and wheelchairs that are just manual operation wheelchairs, lockers that barely lock, but and pool tables that are just covered in silver for some reason and have blue felt. The most science fiction thing was the hallways and the terminals. So that's my redeeming feature. Is the movie itself redeemable? No.
Fair enough. I was hoping for you to be the champion of this movie, but
I think I will buy a copy of it because like. It's enjoyable enough, but I've definitely seen worse films and definitely seen worse vampire films, but I've seen a lot better vampire films and I've seen better alien films, better science fiction stuff. So yeah, I think it kind of deserves its ratings that it gets. The dialogue's cheesy. The
Some of the sets are bad. The acting is okay, but the actors didn't really know what they were doing. I think the direction was horrible. I didn't much care for the camera work or the framing of certain shots or anything like that. Yeah.
Fair enough. So it's not redeemable, but you would still like a copy and you would like to watch it again.
Yeah. That's the impression I get. I collect really bad films, so I would enjoy it. Is it so bad that it's good? Not quite, but it's bad enough that it's okay, and it's a good example.
Fantastic, Christian. What are your thoughts as to whether or not this movie is redeemable or has any redeeming features?
God, I wish I could even praise the corridors or the color coding of the corridors, because that'd even be something for this movie. Because honestly, like, you know, as I said, going in completely, you know, not being completely familiar with, say, the science fiction genre too much, and I don't know, I'm always sort of going in with sort of the deep end, but I found that a lot of the sort of movie tropes, as I mentioned, sort of from horror films and sci-fi films of yesteryear were thrown in, everything including the kitchen sink, and I think that was sort of what went against it. I've said it so many times, but the fact that they didn't let their guard down and just have fun with this. But the thing is, I've got to remember, this wasn't made in the 50s or 60s. It would have worked possibly very well if it came out then. Heck, it would have been so much fun to watch this in the 50s.
And, you know, absolutely. You know, that would have been crazy. Crazy cool.
You know, but there could have been so much they could have done with it, and in hindsight, we could sort of look at it being quite camp, but tongue-in-cheek's probably a better word for it, and whereas I find that it being from 2004, there's a lot of mistakes that they made that they really shouldn't have been making in a film like this, especially for the sort of people that would have been appealing to, being Dracula nuts or sci-fi fans, you know, and I just felt that it was, for an 83-minute movie, I struggled so much to get through it, and I felt that the slight plot just made it, I'm going to say slight plot, well, yeah, essentially it was, you know, you've got these people, terrorized by, you know, in space, you know, by this Orlok, you know, which I think if they just sort of stuck with that rather than bringing in this whole Van Helsinger and trying to continue, I suppose, the canon or whatever you want to call it, or making it being another sort of Dracula film, I think that's where it sort of went against it. I think if they'd just taken that away and made it like Jason X, the Friday the 13th film set in space, I think it would have felt a lot better. Look, I love B-grade films and sort of campy movies, but hey, I found this incredibly dull and boring. And Trevor, we've watched a couple of direct-to-TV movies, and they haven't been kind to us in the old redeeming features, so I don't know. I don't think I can say I can redeem this one. I support very much the one-star review that you read at the start. I pretty much nodded my head to every point about that, and yeah. I do not want to own a copy of this movie because I do not ever want to see this movie ever again. So that's my take on it.
Okay.
I read one review where they were comparing it to Plan 9 from Outer Space. Do you reckon if it was made back then, like not necessarily by Ed Wood, but do you reckon it would have been like a Plan 9 from Outer Space?
I think if they'd managed to have, if they're all sort of on the Coolio level of acting, God, that's expecting a lot, isn't it? You know, if they all weren't sitting there quite a lot of them, but it's like what you said earlier. I think a lot of them were, like you said earlier, I think they dulled their characters down until they were bitten so they could actually sort of, you know, ham it all up. Made in a different era, it would have been a lot different. And hey, I've mentioned those sort of 70s blaxploitation or the sort of 70s campy Dracula films. It belongs very much in that sort of that frame as well. So it's just a shame it was made in an era where it sort of didn't work.
It was made in the space exploitation era, kind of, if we could call the noughties that. Yeah, I don't know, probably not.
Ooh, it's on the cusp, but I'll allow it just this once.
It definitely was. I have a theory about music videos around that time were very space exploitation. I don't know what happened. Did we do something significant in space? I don't know, but there was a whole bunch.
Might have been post, Y2K or all that sort of stuff.
Or maybe we hadn't done anything significant in space for a while, so everyone thought space was cool and different again.
And nobody wanted to talk about destroying buildings, so they were like, oh, let's go to space.
It's safer up there, because in space no one can hear you play football. But anyway.
Okay, so we're two irredeemable so far, so... do you think I can maybe bring this back and give it a bit extra? Neither do I.
Damn it.
So, yeah, I mean, I've mentioned before, I did like the tagline, in space there is no daylight. That was kind of cool. I do think that Coolio and Grant Swanby as the professor, maybe they can get a nice little participation pin for their attempts at hamming it up and actually adding some life to what was a very lifeless movie performance-wise. But I don't think they really had the acting chops to go the full scenery too. But their effort was admirable. I was happy it was 83 minutes, but it did seem so much longer. I will admit that I actually had to re-watch a bit of this movie the following day because I actually realized I fell asleep during the entire scene where Aurora first met Count Orlok. which is always a great, great sign. And the fact that I looked at my watch and went, why does this still have 20 minutes to go? It was only in 83 minutes, but it's still going. The acting was bad, full stop. Those close-ups, I got so sick of the close-ups. I'm thinking, I have seen these guys' faces more than enough. Yeah. Set-wise.
Can I mention the extreme close-up they do of Abraham Van Helsing's eye at one point?
It's
kind of like half his face and the background, because I think it might be when they first find the old captain, the skeleton. And he's supposed to be like shocked by that or something, but it's like they just do like a shot of his eye for some reason.
I know.
It's so weird.
I didn't need to see any more of those actors than I'd already had, say, with about a quarter of the way through the movie. So the relentless close-ups.
Colors of the scenes. There was a few that were just flesh colored because it was so close, so many close ups of people's face.
Very true. I did quite like the industrial set. It was obviously, they found a factory or something with the appropriate catwalks. There was one corridor that they seemed to get a lot of use out of. A lot of the shots of people running down corridors seem to be the same corridor. And the fact that the female lead just gets completely undermined and discredited right at the very, very end, which is just like, that
it's a horrible film for feminists.
So not needed. That was so unnecessary.
Yeah.
And it just puts the rotten icing on top of a moldy cake. So,
that's not even not necessary at all, and you could actually stop watching the film before that scene happens. Like, you stop watching when Orlok's arm gets cut off, and then you go, and then you'd be like, roll credits at that, and you would never have that bit, and the film would be better for it.
Yeah,
I feel.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think if any sort of female audience that would have been watching this would have been completely, if they had been won over by the film, would have completely lost them at this last scene.
I think it's safe to say that any female audience watching this movie would probably walk away and try to watch something better, because they're more sensible than us.
It's the key, though, because it's the very last scene, and especially it's the stinger. That's just that whole area and the credits is just really offensive. But they get you, because you can't walk away at that point, because it's already over. The film's like, you can't quit, you're fired.
You're done.
So it's kind of like,
I'm annoying
for us, because we have to watch to the end anyway, don't we, Trevor? We always have to watch it to the end, so that's always the most.
I should say I had no problem watching watching this film. Like, the length of it was fine, and I didn't find myself getting tired. I think I'm very good at paying attention to films and not getting lost, even if they're the most dull piece of junk ever. I do watch a lot of surrealist film, I guess. I don't know, but
You need that for that, yeah.
Okay, so you had special training. Me, this movie is not redeemable, and I never want to see this piece of trash again.
I could watch it again. Mostly just to criticize it.
Fair enough, fair enough. So there we go, a resounding triple irredeemable for Dracula 3000. We are off to a flying start in 2016. But, we didn't like it. David likes it enough to want to get a copy and watch it again. But this movie does have its fans, and I did indeed find some 5-star reviews.
Wow.
I've got to say, though, Because I source my reviews from Amazon. It's nice and easy to do it that way, and I don't require much effort for myself. There are only 6 5-star reviews, which I do believe is a new record. Normally it goes over a couple of pages at least, but this was just that's it. So I had to select from a not very good selection. So this one is titled Stop the 1-star Ratings. Whoa! All you people putting 1-star and saying this was a bad movie. In caps, no, it wasn't! This movie was as funny as hell, and the acting was perfect. For any Dracula fans, buy this movie now. Coolio is extremely funny. And the movie, too. I recommend it. 5 stars.
Oh, my word.
I think it's Coolio's fan club who wrote that. Sorry, what did you say?
Oh, that's got to be it. Yeah, it's got to be either being completely sarcastic or it's someone who was involved in the making of the film or someone who, really loves Coolio. Like, I suppose I don't smoke weed, but if you were into doing drugs or whatever and you watch this, you might find it terribly, terribly hilarious.
I suppose
that might be the Coolio connection. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like if you were someone who enjoyed cinema and enjoyed getting high, you would end up at this film very quickly because of the Coolio connection.
You've got to admit, Coolio did. Coolio did feature in a number of these reviews.
Mm-hmm. He's what draws a lot of people to it. I think once I mentioned that when I was talking to Colin Smith about it, that was when everyone was like, wow. Yeah, I think, Coolio is I think he's done a lot for this film. I don't know how much they paid him to be in it. It can't have been much, but, oh, man. Yeah,
he gave it his all. You've got to admire that. Definitely. From a typecast role to a raving, hyperactive vampire slash thrall. You know,
yeah,
he has the most range.
Demon creature. Yeah, he actually does. You know, he actually does. Yeah, even more than the android, who goes from being kind of not very interesting to being just not very interesting still. And and Tiny's playing his usual thing where he's an intimidating kind of pervy big black guy. Udo Kier is just reading to a camera. I don't think we've spoken much about his performance, but it's almost literally phoned in, where like he's probably the most respectable actor in the whole film, but he's just phoning it in for this one.
Yeah,
it must have been really easy to say yes to be in it, because they're like, oh, don't worry. You'll just be speaking to a camera the whole time, and we'll have cue cards right there, and you can do it all in a couple of hours.
Yeah,
it's like we'll film it in your lounge room too, because we're filming the rest of it out in the garage out the back. So.
Yeah, that was the condition. They were like, he's like, can I film it in my lounge in my lounge room? And they're like, oh yeah, if we can film it in your garage, that'd be awesome. And then we can claim the whole thing on tax.
Oh gosh, but I'm glad. I don't want to see that again.
Fair enough. There we go. Okay, well, that's a first one down for the year, and it's not redeemable. So, I guess this is the point where we wonder: will things go up, or can they go further down? Now, if you are new to the podcast, we did start with this one, which was very kindly suggested by David, which we really, really do appreciate, and we encourage anyone to do. More details on that soon. But when we are going through, Christian and I like to surprise each other and reveal what the next movie is going to be at the end of the podcast. And, Christian, I'm going to let you go first this time around. So I'm wondering, what are we in store for the next Redeeming Features cast?
Oh, God, Trevor. Well, let's just say I don't think we're going to be going up from here. I think we can possibly only ever go down. And actually, probably in the movie quality and also in the subject matter, we're going from space down into the sea. Ladies and gentlemen, this movie was a sequel to a film from the early 90s was unfortunately released. I have not only seen it once years ago, and the experience was something that, yeah, I don't know, it's definitely wanting me to rediscover. But let's just say the first film was about a bus that was going at a certain mile per hour. This one is set on a boat. I'm looking at Speed 2 Cruise Control from 1997.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think we even mentioned Willem Dafoe earlier. I actually think he's the villain in Speed 2, so a bit of a segue there. But yeah, so let's revisit this film, which apparently is quite terrible and is full of scene-chewing scenery like the film was. So yeah, so always a fan of the old sequel, aren't I, Trevor?
Let's see if
Speed 2 is redeemable or irredeemable, but it might even be a little bit better than Dracula 3000.
We shall wait and see. it is. I'm saying it is. There we go.
Yeah, I watched it. I watched Speed 2 recently, and it is. It's a bigger budget, though. Sometimes with films, you can be like, well, that was a shit film, but like, they only had a small budget to work with. Whereas Speed 2, the budget would have been amazingly huge. And so maybe think about that when you're criticizing it. It's probably a good idea.
Oh, definitely. So we'll make sure you have a listen, David, when we release the Speed 2 one, because yeah, you might see some things that we've picked out that you didn't think of. So
yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Like that's gonna be great.
Yeah, maybe we'll praise it.
Maybe.
Got up a nice mess. I'm waiting to praise something.
And David, thank you so much for joining us. So before we do the full wrap-up, was there anything that you wanted to plug, promote, or tell all the listeners out there?
Mostly just go check out Priori Podcast. It's another podcast where there is some chatting about films, if you like films. So and writing and stuff like that. Yeah, it's good. I'm sure you've heard about it already, but it's great.
Yeah,
check it out.
Definitely check it out. And if you want to check our back catalogue, we do actually have a chat with the cast of the Priori podcast. David, I believe you do the sound engineering. Job at that, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
And I have heard you a few times in the chat afterwards, so I'm a big fan of Priori myself.
It is good.
With regards to Christian and myself, definitely keep listening to the mini podcasts that come out the weeks that this podcast doesn't come out for all those details. Or you could head to RufusProject.com, our brand new website. I'm so excited!
We're in the big league now.
Yes. Or, of course, Christian has ChristianFetcher.com for all his events. Now, do you think we've been too harsh on Dracula 3000? Do you hate it so much that you think we've been too generous? We would love to hear from you, and it could not be easier. You can send us an email to therufusproject@gmail.com. You can head to rufusproject.com and leave a comment below this very episode. You can find the Rufus Project super duper easily on Twitter and Facebook. And pretty soon, maybe even Tumblr. We're going to expand our reach a bit out there, and we would definitely love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions for movies, if you have a movie that you love that everybody else hates, let's see if we can help you out in your next discussion trying to champion your guilty pleasure. We would love to hear from you. This has been a great chat about a very irredeemable movie. So, David, thank you so much for suggesting it, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This has been really fun.
Fantastic. And Christian, as always, thank you very, very much, and I will see how I'm feeling towards you after I watch Speed 2.
You might not ever speak to me again. This might be our last one. Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us too, David. And yeah, and always welcome a chance to welcome any other recommendations for films. So
yeah, I appreciate it. I'll be sending you guys heaps.
And check out our back catalogue of redeeming features, because we've done some doozies that you might not, some doozies that you might not have even thought of or seen too. So definitely recommend that, and also for our listeners too.
Yeah, cool. Have you done ones from the 1950s and stuff?
Yeah, we've done, like, you know, all sorts of things, like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, all sorts of different things. So, yeah, so go get into our, got onto the archives, and, yeah, you'll be able to listen to some great ones. But.
So, yep, head to RufusProject.com, where you can stream or download every single episode of The Rufus Project.
I'm going to do it.
Ta-da!
Or you can subscribe to us through iTunes or your favourite podcast player.
Fantastic. There's lots of options, so.
Fantastic. Okay, well, again, gentlemen, thank you very much, and let us never speak of Dracula 3000 again.
Definitely. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thanks.
Too good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm BB, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.